Hi, I'm Richard Burnaby, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Lens, where I speak with inspiring and creative people from all over the world about photography, the arts, travel, conservation, entrepreneurship, and creative culture. In this episode, I'm joined by legendary photographer Art Wolf. This is Art's second appearance on Beyond the Lens, and you can check out our first conversation in episode 35. Please check that out if so inclined. Art graduated from the University of Washington with degrees in fine art and art education, and his subsequent very celebrated photography career has spanned more than five decades with more than 100 books published and many, many honors. To be honest, Art hardly needs an introduction, so I think I'll leave it at that. We mostly discuss Art's new wildlife photography book, Wild Lives, and expand that discussion to wildlife photography philosophy in general. Art's website is artwolf.com. Wolf is spelled W-O-L-F-E. Don't forget that E on the end, artwolf.com. Instagram at artwolf. And my conversation with Art is coming up right after this short message from one of our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Luminar Neo. Friends, let me tell you about this incredibly powerful photo editor that I love called Luminar Neo. Powered by AI technologies, Luminar Neo streamlines the editing process and provides everything you could possibly need to get photos that will look amazing on the screen and in print. Luminar Neo was designed for both hobbyists and pros and includes cutting-edge editing tools all in one intuitive and easy-to-use app. It uses generative AI to intelligently analyze your photos and erase distracting elements in your compositions, add realistic objects that seamlessly blend into the background, or expand the frame in any direction. If that's your thing, of course. If not, it's still one of the most powerful photo editors when keeping your images natural and realistic as well. How you use it is totally up to you. Luminar Neo has all the features you need to enhance your images with precision and ease, and again, I can't stress enough how incredibly easy it is to use and how powerful this editor is. You can use Luminar Neo as a standalone app on your PC or Mac computer, or, if you're like me, as a plugin for Adobe Lightroom or Photoshop, so you can keep your existing workflow. Learn more about Luminar Neo and how it can amplify your creative vision for your photos by visiting skylum.com. That's skylum.com. Art, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Richard. That's really a pleasure to be here talking with you.
It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
We're going to talk books for a moment. You published dozens of books. I know you're not counting. And even if you were, you're too modest to say what that number would be. And you've covered a wide range of book topics. For example, you've done a book on wolves, elephants, humans, tribes, the human canvas, for example, water, trees. And I'm wondering how you decide when it's time to do a book on a particular subject. So do you wake up in the morning and decide to do a book on trees, for example, or do you look over your portfolio and notice a pattern? And boy, I've got lots of photos of interesting trees around the world. Maybe I should do a book. What's the process? Where does that idea come from?
It's a great question, and it's a little bit of publisher desiring to do a book on trees. I would never have come up with that as a subject, but I already had a lot of trees, so it was a slam dunk. So when I agreed to do a book that is pitched to me by a publisher, I have Deirdre in my office kind of do a check through the archive and see if we've got a body of work that can be added to in 2 years or 3 years. And that's happened a couple of times. Like the book on elephants, again, was not my idea. But you hit upon it on your question. When the book ideas, and most of them do originate with me, it's after I've already been working on a subject, not even with a book in mind at that point, But when you have 10 or 15 photos, you have a magazine story. And when you start to have 30 or 40, you've got the beginning of a book. And once I really zoom in on a concept of a book, then it's like, that's the only thing that matters to me. And so, and I generally will work 9 to 10 years on a book before I bring it out, simply because I've bought too many books where the beautiful cover and you start to open it and it quickly fades into mediocrity. And I want any book that I bring out to be as good as I possibly can make it. And that means from the cover to the back cover and all everything in between should be a strong image. And the other thing about that, Richard, and I know I'm wordy, but I tackle on books that have a different theme just to keep it interesting to me. For instance, I've done multiple books on wildlife, but each one had a unique vision. Migrations was patterns. Rhythms from the Wild was blurred motion. Vanishing Act was camouflage in nature. The Living Wild was wide angle perspectives where small animal, big environment. So this last one, Wild Lives, is much more of a personal broad look at international wildlife. And I brought it out largely because if you turn on the news, if it bleeds, it leads. It's negativity, climate change, things, the latest murder. Certainly politics is something nobody really wants to talk about.
No, thank you.
So there's good stories out there. You know, there's more whales in the ocean than there has been in 60 years. There's more mountain lions in North America than there has been in 200 years. A lot of the endangered species like mountain gorillas and snow leopards are holding their own, and if not growing in population. Tigers are growing in population. People need to hear some of this positive story. Otherwise, they get worn out and demoralized. And so I wanted this book to be an honest look at international wildlife and the things that are being done to save a lot of the critically endangered species.
Do you remember 15, 20 years ago, people were saying that printed books were dead?
Yes.
How did that turn out?
Well, what happened is printing and binding and paper became cheaper. And I'm not entirely sure whether it was the Chinese that came into the market of production, but certainly a lot of the best books for me in the last 5 or 6 years were printed in southern China, just outside of Hong Kong. The price of books at a time when the audience is shrinking, the bigger books are coming out. And so there's less books being published, but the ones that are tend to be big and beautiful books. And there's going to be an audience. I'm an example of that. Somebody that loves to look at books. I've got a full library of hundreds and hundreds of books. And I love looking at them and I find inspiration in them.
Why do you think printed books have been so underestimated as far as their enduring relevance? Because the demand obviously is still there.
Yeah, I mean, the younger population really is looking at their imagery through the electronic medium. People of my age tend to get bored with that. And in fact, there's that tactile feeling. And when a book is really well done, it's just a joy to look at when the paper quality is there, the printing quality is there. The best time for me to look at an image when it's really well printed in a book, as opposed to even looking on my computer. And so for quality, that a book is the best way to go if, in fact, you find a publisher that has the same aesthetics as you do.
So your newest book, you mentioned already, Wild Lives. Was this one your idea or a publisher?
My idea. Yeah. And in fact, the previous book, big book, I mean, he's done about 4 books with me. He is Raul Joff, and he lives in San Rafael. And he originally had a paper company. So he brokered paper for publishers. And finally he said, well, I've accrued a lot of knowledge about how publishing works. So I think I'm going to take a stab. One of his close friends was George Lucas, a neighbor of his. And so he started doing these big books on Star Wars and met with a lot of success. And so when I met with him, I was pitching him a specific book. And he said, no, I don't want to do that, but I would do your opus. And I thought, all right, what is an opus? I actually didn't know. And he said, it's a look at your best work, whether it's culture, landscape, or wildlife. And I said, if you're willing to do that, I'm totally on board. So Tales by Light came out. No, not Tales by Light. I'm sorry. There's too many books. Earth is My Witness came out. And it was such a beautifully presented book that I was eager to do more with him. And in fact, I've got 3 or 4 in kind of like planes ready to take off on a tarmac.
I'm glad your friend used the word opus, because that's what it is. I mean, this is one of the most comprehensive wildlife books I've ever laid my hands on. And I have an entire bookshelf of photography books right behind me, including several of yours. If I were you, I couldn't imagine needing or wanting to do another wildlife book after this. I mean, this is a magnum opus, drop the mic project. I mean, what else could you possibly do in this wildlife genre?
You're absolutely nailed it. I could bring out a second book of all the ones that didn't make the first cut. And the reason they didn't make the first cut is that there was a redundancy in bears or whatever it may be. And so I have no desire to do another book on wildlife, because I think this is it. This is the best work of my life when it comes to wildlife. And I'm so pleased with it. When I first, you know, the best time when one works on a book is when it comes in a package and you sit down and you look at it for the first time. It's just fantastic. Anyway, I agree with you. I think bringing out another book, unless it really had a different angle to it, there would be no reason to do an international wildlife book. But I've got other books that are going to be equally compelling in the years to come. And one I'm almost finished, it's called Act of Faith. And I love, Richard, to do books that are not expected of me. And I would cite Human Canvas, definitely was one of them. Mm-hmm. This next book is, well, I don't know if it's going to be the next book, because there are sleeping years where we bring out smaller books. And this book that I'm talking about is called Act of Faith. And it looks at all the big religions around the world, but also voodoo, shamanism, animism, all the kind of things that people believe. And it's really not about mosques or synagogues or cathedrals. It's really about humans and their passion and their celebrations. And so there are structures in the book that are amazing to look at, but it's really about people lost in their belief system.
Yeah, I think the last time we talked, you had just gotten back from Ladakh.
Well, now it's we've got a string going, because I just came home from Delhi about a week ago, and I was there photographing 15,000 Muslims on the last day of Ramadan, and they're all praying in front of me. I mean, I'm on their backside as they bend forward towards whoever is leading the prayer session. But it really is like migrations. It's a book on patterns. And as much as I can bring an element of art to the subject, then I'm really pleased with it. And I think this will be a really beautiful book, because so much of it is built around celebrations that is centric to the religion that I'm visiting.
Right. So let's get back to wildlives for a second.
Okay.
Not long after opening up the book, I came across a photograph. I think it's on page 11. And it's a moose standing in water. Looks like a shallow lake of some kind in British Columbia. And I got to tell you, it's out of focus. It's grainy. The light is harsh. It's just not up to the Art Wolf standard. So what is it doing in this book, and what's the story behind it?
You know, it's interesting. There are several photos in the book that go back to the 80s, early 80s. And in today's world, we can scan an old slide and work on it in Lightroom and even denoise it. But I don't know. I love that one simply because all the water's dripping off its antlers. If we're talking about the same one, it's no.
We're talking about a photograph you took in 1967.
Oh, okay. Got it. All right. Thank you. Because I was trying to defend a photo I like.
I'm trying to give you a hard time.
Yeah. That one was shot with a Brownie Fiesta. And if you can imagine, any camera of that era generally was plastic. And the way you advanced it is you pinched your fingers and you twisted a little knob on the bottom of the frame and you would just see the number go slowly from 1 to 2. And oh God, it was so archaic. But it was the only camera I had, and it was the first camera I ever owned.
The way you presented it was your first photo, which is why I'm giving you a hard time about it.
It is. It is absolutely the first. Well, let's just say it's the first wildlife photo I ever took. I can't even recall if I clicked. Yeah, I must have been, because this was on a 80-mile canoe trip with a bunch of kids from the YMCA. And so I would have taken other pictures with that, but that definitely was the first wildlife photo.
No, I'm not going to give, I had nothing to say about an Art Wolf photograph other than good things, but I had a reason to call that one out because
I was wondering going with that.
That was Art Wolf photo number one taken on a brownie, and it's you put it in there for a particular reason to show.
Yeah, I mean, just think, I went from the Brownie Fiesta to a Konica camera that my parents gave me, which had no instructions whatsoever. I can remember opening the yellow Kodak box and looking straight through both set columns of slides all the way to the bottom of the box. In other words, they were so grossly overexposed, there was virtually nothing to see. And then I realized, well, maybe the numbers on a lens has something to do with taking a picture. And that's how primitive it was. And without any instructions, I never had a class. I just kind of learned these mistakes are burned into your skull. And so from that point on, I really paid attention to kind of adjusting. And we're talking about the Konica camera now. There wasn't much you could do with a Brownie Fiesta, but the Konica was more of a modern 35 millimeter, but my parents picked it up in a used camera store and nothing else came with it, including the instructions. So, and they were both photographers, but they were using 4x5 speed graphics to shoot weddings at the time.
Which I understand you had also at one point.
Yeah, they gave it to me. You know, what happened is for the longest time, weddings were shot with large format, generally black and white. And then people like my mother would use cotton swabs and dyes and hand color these black and white photos that people wanted for their wedding albums. And then the 35 or the medium format, Yashicas and Asai Pentax, I'm probably butchering the name, they came in and they replaced all the 4x5s. And my parents used that as a catalyst to change job descriptions. And they wound up buying a little shop, letter presses and other presses. And they spent the rest of their lives working side by side, printing, you know, business forms and letterheads and things like that. They gave me a little blue blazer and I go out and knock on the doors of businesses around Seattle. And I made quite a few sales because they thought I was just so cute at around 17, you know, knocking on the door, asking to see the purchasing agent. So that's all part of that history right there.
You do a lot of different genres. You mentioned the new, you know, the what did you say that the title was? Leap of Faith or A Matter of Faith?
Oh, Leap of Faith would be a good title too, but this is Act of Faith.
Would it be safe to say that wildlife photography is closest to your heart and where your passion burns deepest, or are you a generalist in nature?
I am completely a generalist. And, you know, there's liabilities with that. I study a lot of art history, and the people that come to the forefront generally stay with a theme their whole life. Like Seurat, this French pointillist painter, never diverted from that kind of concept. It's been it is a bit of a liability when you shoot such a broad range, but it serves me well because I'm a restless spirit. And I studied under one of America's greatest African-American painters, Jacob Lawrence, and he kept on goading me to keep experimenting and broadening my painting ideas. And I just apply that concept every time I go out with a camera, that the biggest fear is coming up with no idea. And a writer's block is another way of saying it. And so anytime I get bored of a subject, I just change the playing field or the destination and my new ideas and new concepts. And I'm often reliant on looking back at art history, coming up with concepts. Henry Russo is a famous painter who painted this nude woman reclining on a bench, and she's right in front of a jungle. And in that jungle, you can just see cats kind of peering out. And that became the kind of the catalyst for doing Vanishing Act. So I'm like a sponge. When I see an idea, I want to run with it, but with my own sensibilities and ideas. There's no copying somebody else's concept and trying to do it better. I don't spend any time actually on Instagram or Facebook or any of the other platforms from which people look at photos. I rather have the concept of putting blinders on like a horse and just focusing on what I want to do. Otherwise, if you get too caught up at looking at all the great photos other people are shooting, you would wonder, why would you even pick up a camera at that point? So ignorance for me allows me to be pure to my own concepts without being flooded with too many other people's work that can really demoralize you or frustrate you or confuse you.
Is it also because you don't want to be influenced by, inadvertently influenced by other photos you see?
That's part of it.
Because that happens a lot when you're preparing for a trip. You know, you want to get a sense of a place, but at the same time, you don't want to research too much and see too many images that might influence. And
I think that's a great response. But when you Google images for a place, generally speaking, a lot of the photos are pretty weak. You know, they're just like weekend photographers that are just grabbing a shot of here or there. We're not talking about really good photos that are also, you can get through Google. But by and large, I'm just trying to get a sense of a place that I've not been. And those places are pretty few and far between at this point in my career. Because I've been working nonstop for 5 decades.
That's amazing.
And I circle the earth every year more than once. And so I have a pretty broad range of ideas about cultures and wildlife and landscapes and political minefields and all those kind of things.
So one of my all-time favorite wildlife photos is yours, and it's in this book. It's on page 82. It's a photo of a brown bear either wading or swimming into a river, and it's full from corner to corner with bright red sockeye salmon, except for about a meter radius on all sides of the bear. I know you know which image this is, and I think you have another one that's similar to it. But can you describe how that photo was taken? Was it just dumb luck in the right place at the right time, or were you tipped off by a guide, perhaps, who let you know that that situation could be possible at that location? Because I'm jealous.
When it comes to bears up in Alaska, and especially in Katmai, I am the guide. We don't have guides because I've got more experience than any guide that's just hired on at a lodge. That is one of my favorite shots as well. And I've been leading tours up there for the better part of 11 years with Gabriel Jacon. So twice a year, we'll do back-to-back tours. I know the bears. The bears know me for the most part. Every year you see new mothers coming in with new cubs and all that. But there are certainly bears that I've photographed for 7 or 8 years, and they have a certain look. And whether they pick up on my voice or one reason or the other, some of the bears, especially the females, will bring their cubs right up to you. And they'll not bark at them, but make some sort of sound that indicates that those cubs should stay really close to the humans while they go up the river 100 yards to catch a salmon. And so you've got bears bringing their babies to you. And the reason behind that is the boar bears, the male bears that haven't bred that female would kill the cubs. And it's true with lions and leopards and other top predators. They often kill cubs or kittens that are not of their own. Getting back to the bear in the river, what was amazing about that bear is never caught a salmon right there because it was swimming in deep water. And the salmon were just swirling around him, almost taunting him because he cannot lunge. He's like swimming and they are much faster. And I knew that place. There's a high cliff. And so you can look straight down. It's a bend in a river, which means in that bend, there was a great place for pooling salmon. Most of the river is shallow, which makes them vulnerable to bears running after them. But in a deeper pool that happens to be at the base of a cliff, it was the perfect scenario to wait for a bear to show up. And, you know, the bears are just coming up and down the river constantly. So we sit up there, we have our lunch, and we're waiting for a bear to come in. And there's so many salmon, it's irresistible that they run and pounce and miss. But now they're in the middle of the river looking for a salmon. And it's so pathetic because they never catch it. You know, they'll wind up diving and coming up with a spawned out salmon. It's kind of a, you know, it's not a great trophy for a salmon that's been dead for a couple of days for a bear to munch on. But some of them are hungry. You know, there's really skilled hunting bears and there's ones that are just learning. Maybe they're third or fourth year cubs and they're just learning how to catch salmon. But thank you for that. I love that one because it's a different perspective of a bear with salmon.
Is that a one-off? Because I think maybe I saw a different variation of it. Was maybe it was taken at the same time.
Yeah, you know, it's that time and that shot was taken on a year when there were record salmon runs in Bristol Bay. So there was way more salmon. Yes, I have shot a version of that, but far less salmon. Say, you know, and the bear is still looking at it. Was actually upriver at a smaller cliff and a smaller pool of salmon. And so it was less striking. You know, the sheer number of sockeye circling this bear is what really makes it
work. That's the artistic part of that image. We'll be right back to the show after this short message. This episode is brought to you by Case Filters. Look, I travel the world with my camera, and I can use any photography filter I like. And trust me, I've tried them all. But I only trust my photos to Case Filters. That's Case with a K, K-A-S-E. Why? Well, they're made with premium materials, HD optical glass, shockproof, no color cast, unlike some filters I've used in the past, round and square filter designs, magnetic systems, filter holders, adapters, step-up rings, everything I need so I never miss a moment. And now my listeners can get 10% off the Case Filters Amazon page when they visit beyondthelens.fm/case and use coupon code Burnaby10. Check it out. beyondthelens.fm/case. Use Burnaby10 at checkout for 10% off your Case Filters Amazon order. Case Filters, capture with confidence. Well, another thing I noticed about, I'm looking through the images in the book, is that you're not afraid to abandon traditional aspect ratios in terms of cropping. And I realize some of this is probably done for the sake of fitting the layout of the book. But what I'd like to know is, as a general matter, do you care if you adhere to standard aspect ratios like 2:3, 4:5, 2:1, or not? Or do you simply just allow for the composition and the spacing, negative space, to determine where the image boundary should be?
Great, great, great question. When I crop, and generally I try not to crop, but my God, you know, recently the last photos into the book were snow leopards. I was using a 1200 millimeter lens. I actually had a 1.4 on, but I found that cropping a 1200 was as sharp, if not sharper, than putting on a 1.4. But those cats, the snow leopards up in Ladakh, India, that high state of India, are so far away, you have to crop. You have to crop into the image by and take out a third of the image just to have a small cat and a big landscape. And when I crop, for the most part, I'm going to crop in a 4x6 or a 2x3 ratio because I don't want people knowing I'm cropping. But there are times where if it's a double truck in a book, often you've got to crop it into more of a 16x9 or even a panoramic. And I teach this. I just taught a workshop in Seattle over the weekend. And I say, I'm fairly liberal on my crops on panoramics simply because there's multiple cameras that have different ratios and nobody's ever going to call you on cropping into a panoramic because we just don't have that dug into our brains. But that's a great question. I do crop when it's absolutely necessary, rarely with a landscape or even with people, but with wildlife where, you know, sometimes you just simply cannot get closer and you want the image actually strong enough. A crop is a perfect way. And when I do crop, then if I know I'm going to be radically cropping, then I'm going to lower the ISO. I'm going to use the best f-stops, which are generally the middle f-stops. So I'm going to make my crops as strong as they can by using the best technique possible. You know, tripod, mirror locked up, middle f-stop, and lower ISO if the animal is stationary enables me to go in fairly tightly and still have a satisfying image at the end.
So you prefer your images to be in a standard ratio of 2 to 3 or 4 to 6?
Yeah, simply because I don't want the book to be too radically, you know, if people just crop the shit out of a photo, for instance, it becomes obvious that they've cropped way too far and it's compromised. If it was a book of all these different crops, depending on the subject, then it would drive a designer crazy simply trying to design a book around all these different ratios. So in a book of the size that Wild Lives is, if you look at a vertical image, generally it's a 2x3, which is very narrow vertical. So, and yet the book is more of a 8x11.5. And so I crop all my verticals into that format because that fits ideally into a page of a book. I don't have really any problems with cropping, but when I teach, I tell people crop to make the image better, but crop to learn the composition so that next time you won't have to crop. Maybe you put on a stronger lens or you move a little closer so that you don't have to crop. Because when you're cropping out, as you know, valuable pixels that you paid a more expensive, you've bought a more expensive camera because of the level of pixels. And if all you're doing is cutting them, it doesn't really make a lot of sense unless you need to.
In your opinion, what makes for an impactful wildlife image? I know light and composition play an obvious role, and those can be taught and learned, but there's so much more. There's an ingredient that gives wildlife and a wildlife image magic. Is it storytelling? Is it the environment, gesture? What are you looking for when you press that shutter?
I think you hit on several of them. I mean, if it's a stunning, a lit image, then, for instance, in the book, there's backlit guanacos just as the sun is about to crest and every hair follicle on five bodies is just glowing orange. And that, to me, is amazing light. The ones that I really respond to is when there's eye contact and I'm a little nervous or I'm emotionally affected by what I'm seeing. I want that translated onto my audience to look at the book. And there's a shot of an American crocodile who's coming straight up at to me. And finally, he stops when his snout is bouncing off the glass on my dome port underwater housing. And, you know, in Africa, you would never want to be in a river with a crocodile. They're so they would just chomp you faster than you can imagine. But the American crocodiles are much more, I mean, there's very rare attacks of crocodiles on humans in the Americas. More so the alligator that is in the ponds in cul-de-sacs or golf courses in Florida and Georgia. So the more people are actually killed or injured by a more timid animal than the crocodile, which is always a little more fearsome. So I felt the power of that moment, but I kept on being reassured from people on a boat that, yeah, you're safe. And yeah, they're in the boat and I'm in the water with this crocodile. But and another situation similar to that was when I was laying flat as I could as a Komodo dragon's walking straight up at me fairly fast. And it was freaking out people that were traveling with me. They were pleading with me to get up and run away. We used to think that Komodo dragons had an enzyme in their saliva that if you got bit, it could get infected so easily. But now we realize that it's not an enzyme. They have a poison just like a cobra. And so when they bite you, you have to cut the limb off or lose your life. And I don't think any of those scenarios really fit into my agenda. So I got up after when I got a really nice in-your-face portrait of it coming my way. But then I definitely got up and scooted away. But the long story to your question, it's a little bit about my own personal remembering of the situation, the power of the moment. There's a shot of a line of hippos and crocodiles standing face to face. They hate each other and they're both deadly predators. And I wasn't nervous, but there is a nervous energy witnessing something you've never seen before. And all those kind of images that impact me will go in the book because I want to impact people's emotions as they look through the book.
So you feel something and you're trying to capture the image so that other people who are thousands of miles away can feel the same thing you felt when you press the shutter.
That's definitely true with every book I've ever worked on, whether it's landscapes, cultures. I want that connection to the subject felt. It's not easy and it's not always, but when you do it and it works, people and tribes was a portrait driven book. I had every person in the book look straight into my camera and therefore into the eyes of the people that ultimately looked at the work. So the power of the moment, that connection between me and subject is conveyed directly onto the audience looking through the book.
You mentioned eye contact also with the wildlife.
Yeah.
What is it about eye contact that elicits an emotion with the viewer?
Well, you know, there's a reason that owls and cats are among the top identifying animals in every environment around the world because they have such forward-facing eyes and they often look straight into your face. A cat generally will attack from behind, but if you stare it down, it won't attack. And so eye contact is powerful, whether it's human or wild animals. And with wild animals, it's almost like you're reaching across time and space and connecting directly with that creature. And so I think that eye contact is what I utilize a lot in my portraiture. And I know there's other photographers that would poo-poo that and say, whoa, no, it's the best shots are candid shots where people aren't even aware you're shooting. And I agree, there's a lot of places where candid shots are perfect because the photographer is not interjecting themselves into or changing or altering what's going on. So I shoot a variety of those kind of images, but the ones that are tight portraits where the cat or the owl or whatever animal it is, wolves, are looking straight into your eye, there's that connection with a wild beast. And I love that.
I agree. I think that's so impactful. Your book is broken down into the Earth's various ecosystems. For example, you have the Arctic, Alpine, Desert, Savannah, Temperate, and Tropical Rainforest. Which of these environments pose the greatest challenge, photographically speaking, and how do you overcome that challenge?
Probably Arctic. I mean, it's just the sheer coldness and spark. You know, in the North American Arctic or the Northern Hemisphere around the world, animals are fewer and far between. So you have to traipse across a bigger swath of land to get to your subjects often. And then you've got the cold, and then there's where are you staying? In Antarctica, generally, you're on a cruise ship or an expedition ship, as I was in the early 80s, all the way through maybe a couple of years ago, the last time I was down there. The other environment is the tropical rainforest, because
I agree.
Everything at one time, I did a book on rainforests of the world. And, you know, and a lot of it, I was also working on the camouflage book. And it seemed like if you're walking through an environment where there could be a viper sitting on a branch that's so perfectly camouflaged, you're constantly looking at every potential step ahead of you, because you don't want to step on a viper or a fertilizer. You don't want to get bitten by a bullet ant, paraponia. There's so many things in there that, and then there's fungus and all sorts of things out there that you're totally unaware of. So I'm never just nonchalant walking through the rainforest. I'm walking with my eyes bulging, looking for anything that could be an animal that's so cryptic you think it's a leaf or something else. Then there's, after a couple of weeks being in the rainforest, everything stinks. And often, if you're down there too long and you have a zoom lens with multiple lenses, sometimes moisture builds up in between the lenses and you're toast at that point. So it's a number of those things. You know, humans, there was a study on our brains, and it was fascinating because they took a stack of 500 pages, and on those pages were everything from a robin to a car to a swimming pool to a hamburger, all these things that we're familiar with. And then they passed it in front of people's eyes so fast that they could not see the image. But the two things that they did see were spiders and snakes. They didn't see cars, they didn't see houses, but they saw spiders and snakes. Two animals that can kill you is what hundreds of thousands of years of evolution has taught us. These are dangerous things. And so they're in our DNA to be wary of. Even if it's an innocuous little wolf spider that can't really hurt you, people don't like spiders. And certainly snakes can end your life without even knowing that you just stepped on a puff adder. So for all the right reasons, I think the rainforests are really difficult to shoot. And then there's the intricacy of the canopy and trying to get portraits of primates that are swinging through the vines. Yeah, I'm going to second guess myself and say rainforests are definitely the most difficult environment. Forget about the cold.
No, just the technical challenges of the rainforest. The light is low. You know, if you're on the forest floor, it's low light. And then when you do have light, it's very mixed and it's confusing. And a lot of the wildlife is up in the canopy, so you're shooting up into a bright sky. I find the rainforest probably the most challenging.
We are agreeing now.
Oh, okay. It's good to know. I'm in good company.
Yeah, there you go. I am in good company too.
This is a criticism I get quite often, so I'm just going to allow you to respond. I think you may have answered this earlier. Criticism that the book, or wildlife photography in general, but we'll just talk about the books for a minute, showcases wildlife at its best and idealizes wildlife. And to a casual observer, it might look like everything's going great. Everything looks fine. What's the problem? And obviously there are problems. So how would you respond to that sort of criticism?
You know, I try to inspire, uplift, educate through positive imagery. I've got lots of shots of nets around seals and whales with harpoons. No, I don't have a shot of a whale with a harpoon. I've got a shot of a humpback with a net on it. I've got those kind of images that we really do provide to companies that can really use it to rally the troops. What's beautiful about Wild Lives is the writing of a dear friend of mine, Greg Green. He took the challenge of writing, and you know, I've known him for 35 years, and he's been a biologist the entire time I've known him. And I kind of thought that he's going to be very academic and very dry and to the point. But in fact, he's a brilliant writer. And so to your question, read the book. And in fact, people should not just look at pretty pictures. They should read the book, because he doesn't dodge that about what's endangered and not doing well. He addresses that. And my role is to put a very beautiful, juicy worm on a hook and try to land people's attention. And there's a lot of books out there with degraded environments. In fact, this is a bit of a leap right now. One of the books I want to bring out is called Photography is Art. And it's all based on abstract expressionism. You know, my background's painting, fine art painting, but also art history. And so I rely a lot on artists of a different era's work for inspiration. Where am I going with this? This is what happens when you're 72. You get on this tangent and you forget the very question. The degraded environments. Yeah. So I'm actually going into old bunkers and batteries and old back alleys and the impoverished areas of cities where there's a lot of graffiti that's been worn away and posters put up and worn away, and the collective of them becomes something unimagined by any one person. And now I come along and I frame the works, I mean, the scribbles, the decay, and I turn them into Jackson Pollock's or William de Kooning's or any number of these artists. And I defy people to look at some of the work and tell me whether it's a fine art, famous artist, or something shot in an old urine-stained bunker. And so degraded environments is what I'm looking for that particular book. But with Wildlife, I'm not going to try to show degraded environments or starving animals or trapped animals or all of that. That's for other books. I still need to be positive and surround myself with beauty, because I think the line between sanity and insanity is often crossed, especially with me when I'm driving, that I want to protect my brain and keep everything moving on a positive level. Because if you work for 5 decades straight, and I don't take time off, I work really 7 days a week, not just on photography, but I have a really beautiful Japanese style garden that constantly requires work. I'm really a bad person when it comes to laying on a beach or doing what a lot of people would do for their vacation. I would really suck at that. So I'm a workaholic, but in a good way. You know, I'm positive. I got a lot of energy and I've seen the world. I've seen every big animal or small animal that I've ever really wanted to see. And so I've been lucky in life.
It's a good segue to what I want to ask you about next. You open the book with a quote from your art professor in college. You mentioned earlier Jacob Lawrence, who's a famous artist, by the way. He says, "Never ever be too satisfied with the work you're creating." And from my vantage point, from the outside looking in, that seems to be a defining characteristic of your career. Is that you're always working, you're always trying to improve, you're never stopping to take a rest. Just look at your work schedule, and that would seem to be true.
Yeah, you know, there's a real trick between being too easily satisfied and always being frustrated. So I try to put that carrot on the stick slightly beyond my reach. At the same time, I can acknowledge photos that are really well made, but there's not a single photo I ever took that I don't really believe I could do better. And I'm not frustrated. I'm just realistic.
Every image that you've made, you could find something that you could have done better.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly over the years, in the early years, with slides. Oh my God, I've thrown way more slides away than most people keep. So I grew up, you know, with ISOs of 25. You know, the animal had to be dead before you get in focus. So all those rudimentary old kind of cameras, I just appreciate everything about the modern cameras and the ISOs and the sharpness of everything. So I'm, you know, it's funny how some people that just come into photography, they bought their first SLR digital mirrorless camera. They're always whining about this or that. It should be better on this. It's like, I'm just delighted that I've got those cameras and I can do things that a handful of years ago wouldn't even have been possible.
You should tell them, you try shooting a moose with a brownie camera. Yeah.
Well, you know, those higher ISO cameras aren't even being utilized by most photographers because they're afraid to go up to ISO 4000. And with the noise and, you know, if it makes the difference between having a sharp image or depth of field that you need when there's herds of animals or, you know, groups of primates, you need those depth, that depth of field. You need to bounce up the ISO. And so many people are old school and they remember the films where you couldn't go too high before it became too grainy. So when I teach, I try to break that perception about higher ISOs. And I'm not talking about doing 23,000 or 123,000. I'm talking about going 8, possibly 6,400, or even on rare occasions, 12. And yeah, I'm pretty happy with some of the results.
So I want to go back to something you said, that you're never quite satisfied 100% of the images you create. So personal question, do you have any of your own photos hanging in your house, in your office?
Yeah, I have the human canvas. Just okay. Because I loved that body of work. In fact, as I'm talking, I'm looking around my bedroom. For the most part, what I have on the walls of a 1910 vintage house, which has got a modern kitchen, and I put on French doors and a brand new bedroom. So it's on the outside, it looks very much like a 1910. On the inside, some rooms are really identical as when they were built in 1910. But what is filled in this house are masks from New Guinea and Africa and primitive art throughout the world, baskets. And then I have labels for where they were collected. And it's virtually a museum. Honestly, it's a museum. When people come to my home, they sit there and they, everywhere you look, there's a piece of artwork. And then all the windows either face out towards the water, the mountains, or trees. So it is by intent that I surround myself with beauty, artwork. The garden looks like a Japanese garden with bonsai trees and waterfalls and all that. So everywhere I look reaffirms and encourages me and makes me happy. And so I tend to avoid people that are always pissing and moaning. Mm-hmm. They don't linger too long in my life because they're a drag. They drag you down. So, and you can see people from afar and read their faces and their expressions and know, just avoid them. I'm getting a little personal here, but that's true. This is my philosophy, is to maintain my sanity, maintain my spirit and health and curiosity and passion. And those things will keep me moving for a number of years.
And keep you young. You also said that you never get into a rut. And this happens to most photographers at some point. What is your secret to avoiding the dreaded artistic rut? Do you have any advice?
Yeah. Do all these different books. I mean, my subject ranges from, well, you know, I used to say I'll shoot anything but graduations, weddings, and bar mitzvahs. But now with Act of Faith, I've been right there at the Western Wall in Jerusalem photographing a bar mitzvah. That is just inevitable that keeps you fresh because you're traveling to new destinations. You've got new subjects and, you know, dog shit with great light could possibly be a good shot. So I am very broad-based and open-minded. And so that keeps you from following the same success that you've had before. you just mix it up intentionally and go to a new location with new ideas.
So the new book is titled Wild Lives, and I can't recommend this book enough, especially up and coming wildlife photographers. I think one of the best ways to learn, aside from practice, is studying other images, not necessarily copying, but studying. And this book is a masterclass on wildlife photography. You have species from all over the planet, aerial, underwater, you have literal abstracts, simple and complex compositions, patterns, motion blur, front light, strong backlight, high key close-ups, environmental portraits, storytelling, any possible way to express our planet's wild animals through a photograph is covered in this book. And the lessons and the inspiration are there if you look into these images. And it's not an instructional book, but it will make you a better photographer.
Wow. Thank you.
So Art, what's the best way for people to get their hands on this book?
It is impossibly cheap through Amazon. I can't believe they're selling this book for $65. I mean, the unit cost and the way they would, a publisher generally would work, there's no way it would be sold for $65. It's $95 through us and with inscriptions. And we've sold probably 1,000 books right out of our own office. But Amazon and other bookstores, I think Amazon's probably the best way to get it if you're on a budget. But believe me, it is a real bargain. There's nearly 500 photos in the book.
It's amazing.
And as you know, it's a big book. It's 10 pounds. Yeah. So I'm going to be later on this summer, I'm heading to Namibia leading a tour. But our work, our co-fixers over there are long-term friends of mine. And I'm going to carry 20 pounds of books because it would cost four times the amount of the book just getting it over there. So I'm going to be schlepping them, as they say, all the way to Africa.
But you also have a collector's edition of the book as well?
Yes. Yeah, we have a beautiful collector's edition with the cover of the book as a fine art print, signed and numbered. And it's just a beautiful presentation of this book.
And they can't get that through Amazon. That has to go through your website.
No, that comes through us. And there was only, I think, 500 of them made.
Okay.
Maybe 200 made. So it's for people that are collectors that really want signed and numbered and limited edition books. We've provided that.
Okay. So you can get that at artwolf.com.
That's correct.
You could see Art's beautiful photography on Instagram also at Art Wolf. And anything?
I've seen my Instagram page once, by the way.
Well, a lot of other people see it.
Do you believe that, Richard?
Art, thank you so much for taking the time. It's great talking to you again.
Thank you, Richard.
Good luck with the book.
I love your questions. Thank you very much.
Bye. All right. You've been listening to Beyond the Lens with me, Richard Burnaby. Thanks to Art Wolf for taking the time out of his busy schedule to join me in this fun and inspiring conversation. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. You could tweet me at Burnaby Photo with any comments or feedback. Hey, I love getting feedback on the show at Twitter X. And if you did enjoy the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, a rating on Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'd love to hear what you think about the show and what you'd like to see from Beyond the Lens in the future. You can sign up to receive an email when a new episode drops at our website, beyondthelens.fm. And don't forget to look for the link to the Richard Burnaby Substack. Here's to truth, adventure, and passion. See you next time.